the spiritual state, the state of the real speaker, so to speak, summed up in the idea of the language of the birds, which as you may know is a famous Slipping poem Peter Brook actually put it on stage while I was working with him, so I'm very familiar with that concept. The original Arabic term is mantiq akher, M-A-N-T-I-Q, which is an interesting word because it means rhetoric, grammar, language, speech. It means all of those things, and it also means logic. So it has that entire, it's not just the language of the birds, it's the logic, rhetoric, and grammar of the birds as well. What is the language of the birds? The language of the birds is, in fact, the language that the angels speak to each other. And going back to the Western occult tradition, God and spirits can speak any language, yet many doubt whether the angels or genii, or the jinn, since they must be pure spirits, use any vocal speech or tongue amongst themselves. But they do. The Platonists say that Socrates perceived his genius, his daemon, as they call it, by sense indeed, but not of this body, but by the sense of the ethereal body concealed within this body. After which manner, Averroes believes, Averroes being given Rus, the Islamic philosopher, believes that the angels were wont to be heard and seen by the prophets after this manner, this purely spiritual manner. That instrument, whatsoever the virtue be by which one spirit makes known to another spirit what things are in his mind, is called by the Apostle St. Paul the tongue of angels. Yet oftentimes they send forth an audible voice, as they were cried in the ascension of our Lord, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye here gazing into the heaven? And in the old law they speak out to divers of the fathers with sensible voice, but this never but when they assume bodies. So this is what Dr. D, the great Elizabethan magician, that is what he thought about the traditional theory of language. So the angels speak some kind of strange language among themselves. We find out more about it by going back to the apocryphal testament of Job, where I have a note here on the phrase, the magnificent things of the Lord. Has been suggested as the title of a collection of angelic hymns. If so, Job appears here to say that the recital of angelic hymns, while entirely open to him in full possession of his mental powers, is inappropriate as a demonstration of sanity. Rather, he will show mental acuity in a way that will not offend the Lord. The great thing refers to the mighty deeds of God, but they became a praiseful recital of the acts of God, and therefore somehow referred to language that was expressed. Luke uses the same phrase to describe the content of glossolalia heard on the day of Pentecost. So now we see there's a connection between the angelic language and the speaking in tongues that is still carried on in certain fundamentalist churches today. If you've ever heard that, it's often hauntingly like language, but it never, so someone never resolves. Since they would hear them speaking strange languages and proclaiming the greatness of God, this glossolalia. As the companion of Paul, who himself knew the tongues of angels, Luke, through Paul, may have been aware of some tradition linking the glossolalic praise of God with angelic hymnody. While there is not sufficient evidence to say that either Luke or Paul knew of this book, the testimony of Job, the concern of all three prophetic experiences of one's ecstatic and angelic brings them closer together in this point of the law. And a little bit more about glossolalia, the dialect of the archons, that means the room, the dialect of those on high, the dialect of the cherubim, the distinctive dialect, the source of St. Paul's tongues of angels. Paul, however, does not use the word dialect. In the account of the Pentecostal glossolalia, Luke uses the word expressly for humans and not for angels. But we also find that when the angel teaches Abraham a heavenly song, the recital of which leads him to a vision of the Merkabah, the divine throne, and the singing of hymns by females or virgins in the language of the cherubim, as well as the notion of the chariot body is also known to other weird, obscure, apocalyptic sources. So, this is, I see a relationship with the idea of the language of the birds. But it's important to realize that that there is a language of the birds that is not just glossolalic, not just blah, 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 but is a direct expression of some kind. And these direct expressions in Sufism are called ecstatic utterances, or in Arabic, shat, S-H-A-T-H, which is not very good, to, and the plural is shat, yat. Not important to you, but it's not a word. Ecstatic expressions. Now, the most famous ecstatic expression was the Sufi Haraj, who said, I am the truth, I'm al-Haq. Truth being one of the names of God, and according to the legend, he was executed for this heresy. Because he was associated, he was actually claiming, or he was thought to have been claiming divinity for himself. But the Sufis see things differently. They see that he was with God, was in effect the divine was speaking through Allah's lips at that time. So that for the Sufis, these ecstatic utterances have almost the same status as the Quran itself. They are actually thought to be direct revelations. So, for example, one of the early Shiite imams, Jafar Sadiq, says, it is not proper for anyone but God to speak of himself by using these words, inni ana, I am not. I was seized by a stupor and annihilation took place. I said, then you are he who is and who will be eternally, and Moses has no place with you, nor the audacity to speak, unless you let him subsist by your subsistence, and you endow him with your attribute. And God replied to me, none but I can bear my speech. None can give me a reply. I am he who speaks and he who is spoken to, and you are a phantom between the two in which speech takes place. So here it isn't speech that's arbitrary, it's the hearer-speaker who's arbitrary, who in fact has no existence. This is God speaking to God through God. Or as you might say in Buddhist terms, the consciousness speaking to consciousness through consciousness. Or Satori speaking to Satori through Satori. As Carl Ernst, who wrote the book on the subject, comes out, and I'll get to it later. Utterance is very close to the koan in Zen Buddhism. Now we're beginning to go farther than just the traditional theory of language and get into the traditional theory of meta language and how to go beyond the limitations of mere language, the language of vulgar. Doesn't consist only in glossolalia or silence, the answer still consists in words, and this is very important. Meta-language is still a language made up of words, but somehow it's going to be different from other languages and from other semiotic systems. And we have to find out what lies that difference. Here's where we're sort of painfully what that little encyclopedia article that I read, the idea that language both makes concepts and shatters concepts. And it's the shattering that we're talking about here in meta language, and this is actually hermeto-linguistics for that now. This is what I just finally decided should be called hermeto-linguistics. This is the result of the Vates' climbing up the ladder and coming back down these words. These are the words of his ecstasy. His, in a sense, standing outside himself. And now we come to this, what I promised you before, this traditional Sufi etymology. The Sufi name Saraj, gives the word shot, but the actual term itself is going to tell you how this term came to be. If the questioner asks the meaning of shot, the answer is that it means a strange seeming expression describing an ecstasy that overflows because of its power and that creates commotion by the strength of its ebullience and overpowering quality. This is shown by the fact that shat in Arabic means movement, in other words, the original primordial root. The flower sifting house is called the shaking house on Mishkat, which is the rear entrance of the primordial root, because they shake the flower so much above the place where they sift it, and sometimes it spills over the edges from so much shaking. Thus, shat is a word derived from movement because it is the agitation of the intimate consciences of the ecstatics, or consciousnesses, of the sufis, when their ecstasy becomes powerful. They express that ecstasy of theirs by an expression that the hearer finds strange. But he will be led astray to his perdition by denying the refusal of Jesus. And he will be safe and sound by avoiding his denial and by searching out the difficulty in it by asking someone who really knows it. This is one of its characteristics. Have you ever noticed that when a great deal of water is flowing in a narrow stream that overflows its banks? It is then said the water chataha overflowed in the stream. Therefore, when the ecstasy of an aspirant or a seeker becomes powerful, when he is unable to endure the assault of the luminous spiritual realities that have come over his heart, it appears on his tongue, and he expresses it by a phrase that is strange and difficult for the hearer, unless he be worthy of it. Have widely encompassed the knowledge of it. That, in the language of those who are familiar with technical terminology, is called chat. So this is one of these sort of curious terminologies. It might be correct for all I know, but that the correctness or incorrectness of it isn't really the issue here. What Saraj is interested in is the words beneath the words, the origin, going to the ta'wil, the hermeneutical digging back into what the word originally meant, discover what it should mean. Properly should mean. He gets this imagery of movement and overflow. And this is what he thinks is the essence of his ecstatic utterances. By the way, many Sufis, more than just Halaj, many Sufis were killed for expressing his ecstatic utterances. The Orthodox religious hierarchy of Islam, the Orthodox religious hierarchy of Islam, has always been extremely mistrustful of this kind of verbal theory. They hold to a much more rigorous, hierarchical idea of the revelation of Islam. They don't see so much the return. Sharp return that's contained in this idea of ecstatic utterance. They're very distrustful of it. And since the outward form of these expressions often seems to violate with the religious law, such as by saying, I am God, which is hideous sounding to the Orthodox Islamic ears. So it's just a horrible statement, because only there is only God. Over and over again, there's only one God, only one God, and he's not begotten, he's beget. There is no, in effect, for the hyper-Orthodox mind, there is an abyss between God and the individual. There is no way of covering that, except by God's action. There is no human action to cover that abyss. For the Sufis, however, there is a human action that deals with that abyss, and the result of that human action is the static utterance. Because, as Jafar said, I am he who speaks. God said, I am he who speaks and he who is spoken to, and you are a phantom between the two in which speech takes place. In other words, the abyss doesn't exist. The abyss exists, we are the abyss. And through that emptiness, somehow these flashes of light, these sparks, the angels have always spoken of in metaphors of light. Fire and sparks, and so the words should be called as light and fires and sparks, so the Hebrew alphabet is often compared to the pillars of fire. worship you. This is from an excellent book called Ecstatic Expressions in Sufism by Carl Ernst, UNST, which is very interesting to find out more about the kind of thing. And he concludes with an interesting comparison, a little less than 2 pages. How are we doing with the time? Okay, I think we're doing all right. So I'm going to read this whole selection here. He wants to make a comparison between the Shat and the Zen Koan. Both are unusual kinds of expressions that are related to spiritual development. Are there any other similarities beyond this? Koan is the Japanese form of the Chinese term Hun'an, meaning literally public records. In the late 9th century on, this term denoted sayings in the forms of questions and answers and anecdotes, and were used by the Chan, the Zen masters, to test their disciples and to indicate obliquely the method of realizing the absolute. As a method, the Koan is characteristic of the Rinzai school, which is also famous for the use of shouting, beating, and other unconventional behavior. And by the way, the scream also exists in Sufism. The ultimate ecstatic expression is a word for scream. For some Sufis anyway, I think the shouting is then the same thing. It's that overflowing the banks of the river, the flowers in the hills, overflowing the banks. There is something of the flavor of the Sufi boasting that in spontaneous dialogue, sometimes called Dharma combat. Do you want to do that in a reference, Dharma combat? Sort of ritualized arguments about, sometimes during these Dharma combat, in the very heat of the dialogue, the ecstasy begins to take place, and the intellectual transcendence. Something that, for example, is very big and critical to that pain. Some American version of that used to take Dharma combat that used to take place between visiting offices and the master of the same monastery. The Sufis did the same thing but less organized. They had these what we call composing manuals. Where, for example, one Sufi says, I have a state with God in which I am so drunk that I can't accept another glass of wine. And another Sufi says, oh yeah, well I have a state with God whereby no matter how much wine he gives me, I'm always thirsty. So that is just kind of one-upping, all in the name of presumably helping each other achieve some kind of realization. The Shatya and Sufism were never used in this kind of teaching method, and it was developed at the time. Largely because of his legal problems. They remained as statements produced in the spiritual state, but they were not systematically made into the subject of spiritual meditation. Actually, that's wrong. I think Ernst is wrong in being so drawn from the statement, because a statement such as Kalaji's Anahat and the truth is repeated over and over and over through the most common approach in all Sufi poetry. And if something that's repeated that often is not a subject of meditation, I don't know what is. But it is true to say that it wasn't organized the way Dharma combat was organized. Another difference between the two is that Shatya described spiritual states and could be analyzed in terms of a spiritual hermeneutic. Koans, on the other hand, were used for a variety of purposes in Zen practice. Though they contained meanings that could be disclosed in enlightenment, koans could not themselves be deciphered as guides to the nature of enlightenment. I think he's overemphasizing differences here. You could say that the comments are deciphered as guides to the nature of the light. Now, although that would be, to a Buddhist ear, that would sound very scholastic and Western. What they're looking for is that flash alone, the flash of insight alone, whereas in Sufism there have been very elaborated philosophical texts in Shatya. In other words, I guess what he's really saying is that there's a difference between the two intellectual traditions that lie behind these phenomena, and that the Western tradition is more discursive, rationalistic, philosophical, and the Zen tradition is more inclined to gratitude and well, you know, it's not discursive, it rejects philosophy. Yet in spite of these differences, which is a word that indeed that's true, one cannot but feel that these two states of types of aphorism have much in common. At roughly the same time that the Sufis were collecting and commenting on the Sufi sayings, Yuan Wu was writing the Pian Lu, which is 1125, and another book, there were various other books, commentaries on the Gospel comments. So there was even a happenstance of time there. Both the Shat and the Koan were anti-dogmatic and sought to leap over the limits of the mind to obtain intimate contact with reality. The anecdotes of the great Chan masters admittedly have a peculiar Chinese flavor informed by the spirit of Chuang Tzu, the Taoist background, and also the Mahayana metaphysics. And this naturally stands in contrast to the world of Sufism, with its inheritance of prophetic revelation, Hellenistic cosmology, and Arab manners. It is probably the prophetic element, the contact with the supreme I Am of God, that most strongly differentiates the Sufi tradition from Zen. So I was talking about before, monotheism is God, and monotheism doesn't, so it's good, it's oversimplified. One apparently does not find the exact equivalent of the Shafi'at for self-proven testimony, the I Am God, in the Buddhist tradition. There are some times, however, that are tantalizing identifications for selfhood, such as what was your original face before you were born. There are more obvious similarities between the Shat and the Koan on a paradoxical level. The topics of the transcendence of duality and the coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites, the overcoming of dualistic vision, the overcoming of the grammatical dichotomy, the overcoming of the false, of the illusion of cause and effect, from the Vajrayana. These are central to Mahayana teaching, of the emptiness of all categories. This is evident in the claims of entity of Nirvana and Samsara. You know, Samsara, but the realization is the world itself, in some sense. And in the teachings of five nights, the Taoist teachings of the black and white circles represent the different aspects of reality. Consider the famous poem of Wu, no, literally means no. The monk asked Master Joshu, has a dog a Buddha nature or not? Joshu, which is Wu. Mu literally means no, but Joshu's answer is not literal. This is a no that denies the ultimate validity of the yes and no. It overturns the wrong-headed notion of separate natures by transcendence of all categories. Now, without categories, obviously there is no ground. According to a modern Zen master, Mu has nothing to do with the dualistic interpretation of yes and no being and non-being. It is truth itself, the absolute itself. The Arabic negation of the word no is la, as la ilaha illallah, the reason of God is love, the reality of the real. It is identified with the spiritual state of annihilation and the black light of Iblis of Satan. Iblis, by the way, is much defended in this school of Sufism. That's the perfect. Which guards the divine threshold against all unworthy visitors. In other words, this is the difference in some of we've seen in the book of Job, which is elaborated about the Lord in the and he did this say that he is the divine law. The Koan and the Shat are alike in their negative approach to transcendence. The being made to be not this, not that, but this next bit, what we're talking about. Making it, not this, not that. In this respect, they both fulfill the requirements of Dionysius' negative theology, that's the pseudo-Dionysius, of course, who wrote the divine, the celestial hierarchy, is the work on duology in the Western tradition. And therefore, also a very meaningful text for those plus and minus of would-be universe. The celestial hierarchy is a pseudo-so-called Dionysius. Even every modern scholar is going to put somebody down and call them pseudo. I mean, this was the person who wrote in the name of the early church, Father Ernest, just wrote in the 6th century, I think, in the Neapolitan tradition. Fascinating book. It's where we get the our present day generally accepted division of the angels into the nine hierarchies. In other words, each of those circles has its own set of seven angels and seven princes. And he also talks about the negative theology of the human body, the bodies, if you test the time, that name is God and not. Since the infinite cannot be adequately symbolized, it is better to refer to it by the lowest of symbols. In fact, Dionysius even says it would be appropriate to symbolize God with words like garbage and carrion. So the very lowest possible. And that's an idea that just appears again in Caesar's intention. To avoid, we do this, to refer to the divine reality by the lowest symbol, to avoid the possibility of confusing symbol with reality. So that we don't fall into that mistake of taking ground for God. So it is that Erigena, the scholar, can say that God is nothing, an ego. When the Koan says that the Buddha is a dried up dirt scraper, or again, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, this should not be surprising. It is simply the language of paradox. Like the paradox, the Koan is an illumination of the condition of the finite in relation to the infinite. Again, like the paradox, the Koan is an illumination of the condition of the finite in relation to the infinite. I am not prepared to follow Father Damien Lannes in calling his any natural mysticism, no reference to the Catholic attitude towards other religions. So, oh, yes, it's natural. It's not transcendently from God. Completed by Catholicism. They're distinct from the supernatural mysticism possible only in an eye-thou relationship with a person who perceives God. At this point, in other words, what Ernst is saying is that this apparent contradiction between the non-eye-thou relationship of men and the very intense eye-thou relationship of supernatural is not a real differentiation, at least in terms of this comparison between the ecstatic utterances. At this point, the nature of mystical experience effectively disappears from the canon of the observers. What is the outsider to know of the state that traditionally can only be expressed by negation? To criticize Buddhist mysticism in terms of Catholic theology is a reduction, not a pure comparison. What different modes of paradox are of the shot and the Koan may be legitimately compared. Quite a bit. That pretty much. Oh, wait a minute. There is, just to sum up, and then we'll try to have some minutes for questions here. There's a summation of everything that we've talked about so far. I'm just going to read you the first poem that is in that book, which is an anthology of Persian Caesar's poetry. And this is a poem by really almost unknown poet named Hel Ali. And let me just read it through first and say a few words about it. Speech, we call it, my friend is clever and I call this a poem on the road bus. Speech is the preface of the book of love, treasury of the king of love, the bounty you seek from the heart. Speech is the bounty you seek from the heart. In other words, the generosity of one's own heart. Love of the divine produces speech. What have I said? Whatever you say is logos, ocean fountain, pearl hoard, incisive proof of the intellect with capital I wrote, whose cutting edge is but the blade of the tongue which reveals the hidden fires, which sears the universe with the heart's candle flame, and whose fire and flame energy. The word is the blade of the tongue, which reveals the different fibers. If the word were not painted on the cosmic page, there would be no sign of Adam in the world, no talk of past or future.
The letters created the world.
Who could have kindled mercy in the heart of the thief of hearts? God. Who could have made Muslims out of infidels, or made the minstrels rejoice, or sparked a thousand flames in a single breath? Logos, the word, is revelation, and we are the high throne. Speech is magic, and we are the enchanters. Life flows from eloquent speech. Where is there room for the miracles of Jesus? In the super poetry, Jesus' typical miracles to restore breath and the life of death by breathing. Which is the Lazarus miracle, the one of the most impressed decision. Life flows from eloquent speech, so where is there room for this miracle of Jesus? Life is the speech itself, is a miraculous substance that gives life to non-life. To witness breath and enliven on the whole universe and render it everlasting. I think we could be talking on one level about poetry. The breath of poetry will enliven in the whole universe and render it everlasting. Revelation takes the form of the Quran, which is speech or logos. In Christianity, it takes the form of Jesus himself. Jesus is the logos. So the comparison here is not between the Bible and the Quran, it's between the Quran and Jesus. The Bible is just a description of the word, not the word itself. But Jesus is also equal to us, both the Christian and the Islam, which knows him as the Kamak Allah, the Word of God, one of the titles of Jesus. For esoteric Islam, the book or word ultimately refers to creation as a whole. Creation is a book, it is a book. Thus to its central manifestation, the perfect man is microcosm, for example, to realize its mystery. But Logos precedes even creation itself, as we have learned from all of our looking at tradition here. The word is not only absolute within creation in terms of the archetypes, the word is even absolute within the Nego itself, within God's undifferentiated unity. God's not yet come into being. The word is already there. Because Quran says, on the Day of Covenant, when God asked all the pre-existent archetypes of the creatures that were going to come into being, God said, am I not your Lord? And only man answered, yea, verily. Only the spirit of man, was the pre-existent spirit of man. And all of this took place in pre-temporality, before the beginning of time, which our friend Zerfan had so many terrible things to say about the relationship between time and language. So here we have, suddenly, in opposition to Zerzan's anti-linguistic critique, we separate language from time, and we have language in pre-temporality. Thus, God's word was heard before even his face, that is to say, his form of self-manifestation, the theophany, God's face, the material world as God's face. The word preceded even this. Even before his face was seen, his word was heard. And I think, this little poem sums it all up very nicely. This is the entire traditional doctrine of speech, all in one short Persian lyric, which is used as an introduction to a book of poems, interestingly enough, a justification for writing at all. And since, as I've said, writing and speech are inseparable for Islam, it's often been called the religion of the book, par excellence. And even to this day, by the way, I have to tell you, in passing, that anyone who deals with words on any level is automatically accorded great respect in that moment of growth. So, for example, when you're crossing a border from one Islamic country to another, don't be afraid to tell the border guard to be a poet. And it wouldn't work at all as nicely in Europe, but it works very well in the Islamic world because a poet has to deal with words. Words are God. Words are God. Muslims, if they find a scrap of paper with print on it, it's great to pick it up and put it on the windowsill or something so that no one will step on it, because there might be amongst those words a sacred word. There might be a word of revelation. So it couldn't be stepped on, it couldn't be dishonor of the bottom of the foot. Words are always exalted. And so this is another reason for me why I wanted particularly to look to Sufism, hoping to find the most explicit laying out of the traditional doctrine of language, because Islam is such a totally word-oriented tradition, more so than any other, I guess. And so that, with the reading of that poem, I trust I've summed up, I know it's terribly inadequate, and maybe we'll have a chance to say more about it, perhaps during my seminar on Friday. We'll at least cover different aspects of the traditional approach to language. But that brings me to the end of what I wanted to accomplish today. Now, next time we're going to look at the 18th century reaction to all of this, the rationalist reaction, mostly flowing from the French encyclopedias, like Voltaire and his associates. And this in the 18th century was the very first new idea about language. Up until that point, as far as anybody knew, as far as anybody ever actually consciously thought about language, it was this traditional theory of language is revealed. Now, all of a sudden, as the monolithic world of the church falls apart in Europe, finally in the 18th century, and for the first time, people can talk about intellectual subjects without using theological vocabulary to do it. One is freed from the religious discourse. A new idea about language appears, and that is that not that it was revealed, but it was invented by man being genius, so to speak. Or perhaps not genius, perhaps by his dad, by his bad side. This is, of course, a matter of opinion. But we'll get into that on Thursday. And now I think we still have 15 minutes or so, and I would like to do two things. First, entertain any questions, and second of all, talk, as I said, about what we want to do in terms of writing if you want to write the law. So, first, questions. Thanks.
I'm curious about the anti-language
ideas
that all the things that you read that use language.
I have to say all of this in language, and that's precisely the sign of how much instruction he has to be done. He's calling to even his own ideas to destroy the afterwards. So he's taking the ultimate degree of next to the total closure of science, the head of metal, the black hole is only disappears. Nonsense, or nothing at all. To, let's say, a more extreme example, the Dada poetry, sound poetry, which is like on the tour, I think is probably the most accepted example of it. Babel poetry, opinion, and I don't want to offend anyone who feels that going to a tradition, following an already existing tradition in all those aspects is what they want to do, and is a good thing. Because if you do want to do that, and if you do consider it an actual response to life's problems, then, yeah, you can go back to a sacred. You can become a Muslim, you can become a Sufi, you can believe, you can come to believe, in some sense, quite literally, that God speaks Arabic. Yeah, and they do. And this is one of the reasons why the Islamic world, why, you know, I think this is one of the reasons why Islam is thriving in ways that this kind of religion. Because they had this concept of a sacred language instead of just of a personal language. We see in after Vatican II, when the Catholics decided to toss Latin out the window, the result was horrendous. Priests and nuns began leaving the church, and the lay people lost interest in it. And one of the reasons was there was no longer a feeling that everywhere in the world, when the Mass was said, it was said in the same language, that everyone spoke the same divine words. But in Arabic, this is impossible. Arabic is not a liturgical language, it's a divine, sacred language. You can never, in theory, the Quran cannot be translated, it can only be interpreted.
Do you think that the sacred language is possible now without
that into a tradition? No, I have to say, my own personal opinion is that would just be a concoction that some people might find useful and others not. It would be a kind of Esperanto of spirituality. And, as we'll discover, and we'll talk a little bit about artificial languages when we go to the 19th century, none of them seem to work. But in fact, for many of the same reasons that the avant garde response to language doesn't seem to work. Why isn't Croatian streaming away from the basis of the spoken language now? It's so damn great. You know what I mean? Why, if this is a new revelation, how come we can't speak Croatian? How come I can't speak to you in the merch language or Dada language or Dada battle? And how come we can't do that? Basically, artificial languages always seem to turn out to have too much of the arbitrary in them. And it's almost as if, and we discover all kinds of reasons why linguists think that language is innate rather than acquired or invented. Because of that very reason, because artificial languages don't work, we can't see a language being invented anymore. That's why people like Chomsky, one of the reasons why people like Chomsky attack the idea of an invented language. So if you're asking, could everybody adopt Arabic? Well, yeah, yes, if Colonel Gaddafi conquered America, we'd all speak Arabic sooner or later. But if you're asking, can we concoct a sacred language that everyone would speak? My own personal feeling is that would be a futile desert. Whether they isolate you as an eccentric is yet another creed, or believe me, there are thousands of them.
Could we find a sacred entity, sacred roots in our own speech? Could we discover the sacred in our own language instead of
that? I do believe, and that's what my conclusion was, is the point to find it, but I don't want to get into that in detail now, because that necessitates, first of all, by getting all the other religious theories out of the way, criticizing them, accepting what we like, showing away what we don't like, and then finally looking at it all in light of the chaos theory. And at that point, I hope to come up with some language that I just couldn't be heard. But I don't myself have much time for it. Probably the duty is to make these appropriate. There have to be reasons for that. To me, they're decisive. I'm not interested in universal language if you can't express the poetic thought. Any other questions?
Names must not be important to God. I mean, they're all the same.
got the medical. These are mayor concerns.
On the contrary, this is a very exciting document for poets because it suggests that words really do have substance. You know, Rambo was right, and that he was wrong when he thought he was wrong. You know, and that you could have, you could possibly have an occult document. But the question is, what occult document? As you said, you know, where can we have a sacred language again? And if so, what's it going to be? Is it our own language? Well, that's, in many ways, moving beyond salvation. All you have to do is read a few advertisements, you know that. Are we going to go back to some other sacred language? Are we going to try to sort of make one up, as my brother did? Or a combination of the two is really what Rambo was trying, something new but rooted in the Western Rambo tradition. And so all of these ways have been tried, and I think Rambo's, in a sense, is the most striking because it was the boldest and it failed with the most spectacular firework, so to speak. And as I say, it gives us the image of the silence in Abyssinia. It gives us the very image of what's wrong with. With modern language and why we have trouble doing it. So, as I say, eventually I do hope to answer these criticisms, at least without him. But that is a mental question. Because if language is empty, the anti linguist is right. The exhaustive expression is plural. Supports of religion. These ecstatic utterances are not anti-religious, they're actually the pillars of the faith, but they can only be said by true saints, and only true saints can recognize true saints. And guess what? You know, guess who has a monopoly on sainthood? The Sufis, you know, with their own self-definition. Your master, you know, whoever you decide is the right. So again, within the Sufi's defense of the ecstatic utterances, there is a very sneaky aspect to this insistence on being yourself a saint, and one almost comes to feel in some of the authors that it's pure tendentiousness, that they really aren't that upset about the idea of an ordinary person having this experience and then maybe sinking back into, you know, melancholy expression or some sort of imperfection. It could happen to anybody at any time, really. It could. But that we have to say this about sainthood so as to keep the mullahs off. You know what I know the mullah is? Keep the mullahs off our back. To keep Khomeini from killing us. have to say that these are religious statements in the narrow sense of the word religion, whereas clearly there's something more. There's always this, a veil is always being drawn over these legal problems and circumstances. One of the things, one of the hermeneutical processes, one of the very first steps in hermeneutics in dealing with any Islamic text is to decide what the writer's relationship to the law, to religious law is, and how he's going to use language to either reinforce religious law, undermine it, or to move aside from it, or to move above it, take some position in relation to it, and all of some of the writers eventually will do this. They must relate to this at some level or another. And unless they're willing to be perceived as heretics, they will think of some kind of, we call it the Sharia cap, to put on the Orthodox hat to wear when they say so. And we can, you can tend to accept, to view those kinds of statements as not always being relevant to us, because they are in fact dealing with tensions in Islamic society that are irrelevant for us. Between the powerful dichotomy in Islamic society between the exile and the esoteric, between the outward and political law, the inner kernel of spiritual pain, a dichotomy which doesn't exist at all in the same way in Buddhism, although it does for a certain extent. It would be more Rumi himself in the moment that he invented those movements, so that they came to him. It could be compared to the child. Afterwards, it would be more like the recitation of a poem by someone who was attempting to read that statement, not necessarily that. According to the Medlevi order, who are in Gurdjieff's, you have to have a certain state to do the world. And if you've ever tried it, you know very specifically what they're talking about. You fall on your ass if you don't know what to do. And there's a certain mental state, inner balance that has to be attained. And that is a mental state that leads to higher states. And then you have, in the world of dance, you have this entire cosmic scheme you created, including the spiraling into the center and the spiraling out. The Medlevi dance could be mapped in this map. Absolutely. So the meanings are all there inherently, but there's no necessity to think that every word of Dervish is on the same spiritual level as Rumi was when he came up with the concept of world, because he did. So, well, whoever did that. Well, of course he had his enemies, most had the Orthodox, but in a sense that story did happen to Rumi, but it happened through his spiritual master, Shams Tabriz, who may have been killed for his outrageous behavior. He disappeared. And one of the theories of his disappearance was that it was his outrageous utterances and behavior that it had some hyper-Orthodox touch to kill him. So that tragedy did touch Rumi's life, although he himself died in bed. And he was so highly respected. And before becoming a student, he had mastered all of the religious sciences. And you couldn't catch Rumi making mistakes in the relationship between theology and mysticism. You couldn't catch it. And he can make very outrageous statements, and yet somehow they can come back to a central moment. Of course, there are people in Islam who reject all Sufism, and therefore, if they had a chance, they would bring Rumi up. But in fact, it didn't happen to him because he had the luck to live during the regimes in Turkey that were, for reasons of their own, political reasons of their own, pro-Sufism. That's what it was. Otherwise, he might damn well have done that. Well, I really like to get into that more in the next quarter and the conclusion of the lecture. But the quite a terrorist because my updating of the unacknowledged legislature shows that I'm kind of partly in response to the terror and the let's say the whole anti-art tradition, but this one isn't only just an anti-word tradition. You can extend it to all things and to all semiotic systems, to all kinds of artistic production.
And I think especially in America where words are
so. Yeah, there's definitely, I will say more about this on Thursday, but there's definitely a terrorist past with deconstructive or even destructive past still facing us as poets and writers. The war against words is far from being over, so we have to find a way to fight it that doesn't destroy language altogether, otherwise we're at a job. We have no role left as a poet. I believe that finally, this question of whether you choose silence or words is going to be very personal. There's no way in which I or anybody else or even in society could prescribe either silence or words. But I'm just thinking that since we're all poets, we want to know how we can carry them on. And one of the ways that I thought of called poetic carrying, by the way, was a conversation with the Tank of Harms company in the school that I came up with. Bloody literary quarterlies aren't enough anymore. We need is poetic terrorism. And really, only recently did I realize I was a free stable shopping. But I think it has a nice 80s ring to it. Yeah, well, those Frenchmen are always doing things like that. The next thing you know, they're trying to be priests. There was this, no, really, literally, there was this famous incident in the 1950s where some of the leftists who were the precursors that came between Dada and Situationism, and they went into Notre Dame Cathedral, and one of them was dressed up as a priest, and he got up in the pulpit and succeeded in getting all the way up the pulpit and saying something to the effect of, I shit on God, and then there was a riot, and he was beaten, and had to be rescued by the police, and a year later the guy was a monk. That's Hugo Ball, he's virtually, in my opinion, the man in the campus, although there's some argument about that, ended up in the monastery. These French intellectuals are always on the edge between, as somebody once said about these monsters, after his hideous novels of Satanism, this man is on the edge, it's faced with a choice between the revolver and the altar. And he chose the altar too. If there are no more questions, it is unless we're worried over time. But what does anybody have any feelings about what we should do about writing? I don't. To tell you the truth, do that. If you want to write something, I'd be very happy to read it, discuss it with you, and you may even, I'd even encourage you to do so because a little feedback in this area is going to be extremely useful. This is very much an essay in the sense of a literal French meaning of an attempt that I'm making here. And the deeper I get into it, the more tentative it's going to be. Until we finally reach my chaos theory of linguistics, which at the moment is really just perhaps only the main fancy of my part, so that remains to be seen. So I would very much appreciate feedback, but maybe you'll prefer to wait until after Thursday to do it, I don't know, or if you don't want to do it at all, that's also fine with me. If you do, maybe arrange, I'm supposed to give you a few hours to write me, I'm supposed to have you what I do.
Yeah.
So they might even be able to deal with some tax reduction. If you produce tax, maybe you can deal with them on Friday. Going back over material in light of what some of you might have to say, and you might not, but I really don't care what form it takes. Everything from haiku to a full essay. It's all just gay with me, and I look forward to anything that any of you produce.
We're doing a panel, too, where we'll be presenting about 24 minutes, maybe the same, from the same show to a larger group.
That's
so that would be a
hermetics panel?
Yeah. And I think there's about four people. I'll be chairing it with four people doing.
Well, that's not a good thing.
No.
If the seminar turns out to be a real seminar, you know, then that would be a good place to do it. Otherwise, in private interviews, I'd be happy to see anybody who belongs to the seminar. So I'll see you all in the next